Welcome back to Jay's Real World Podcast. Today's episode took several years to actually get to the podcast that didn't yet exist in 2017. On September 28, 2017, I did an interview with Cornelius Barker in my Dialing from Dialysis series. You might ask, what is dialing from dialysis? Well, when I was on dialysis at that point, I had been on dialysis for maybe 6 months in September of 2017, and I was doing all these different types of activities to do things that were meaningful, to take my mind off of, you know, being on dialysis. I was very active and doing a lot of things, and one of the projects that I worked on was called Dialing from Dialysis, and it was meant to be a podcast. I didn't yet have Anchor, Spotify. I was just sort of on my own at that point, not really sure how to make a podcast. So I kept these recordings. I did a number of interviews. And so that's Dialing from Dialysis. I made that up as a series. I was sitting on the dialysis chair in a dialysis center. So if you hear some beeping and some things, that's sort of the ambiance of background noise while I was receiving my treatment. It was about a 5 hour plus process. I was on for 4.5 hours once I was connected. It took about a half an hour to get ready to be, to have the needles put in and have the machine set up and all that. So we're talking about and a half an hour at the end to, you know, come off the machine. So it was sometimes 5.5, sometimes 6 hours that I would be there at the center. Anyway, the guest that I was interviewing is a very close person to me named Cornelius Barker. He was one of the first speakers that I had in my speakers bureau that I started called A Vision in Motion Speakers Bureau. And Cornelius became more than a friend, I say, you know, a brother, father figure, cousin, uncle, anything you could think of. He was a lot of things to me. We became very close over the years. And we did many presentations. Cornelius, when I met him, was a high school administrator, vice principal, supervisor. He'd had a 25-plus year career as a teacher in the Jersey City, New Jersey public schools. He had had a tough early life. He had been a member of a gang and had overcome lots of different challenges, different abusive situations, gang membership, all kinds of things. His story is really quite unbelievable. And in this interview, you know, I was asking him a lot of questions about things that he went through, and he's pretty candid about it. But when we were working together, we worked with suburban and urban schools, youth. We went to detention centers, prisons. I traveled with him, even in and out of town. We were sort of inseparable in that way. And the stuff that we did together, making a difference with different audiences, had quite an impact on the audiences and as well as on myself. And our relationship became very close, you know. So again, the quality was my talking on the phone in an interview in a dialysis center. So that's the setting, September 28th, 2017. Take a listen.
Thursday, September 28th, 2017, and I'm about to start the interview with Cornelius Lee Barker, MA. And I'm going to ask you the first question. Are you ready to go?
Ready to go.
Okay. What challenges did you face in your life when you were young and in your adult life, and how did you overcome the odds?
Well, I think the best way for me to answer that question would be the fact that my challenges in life was when I was young, more when I was in the house about 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old. Because during that time, I had lived with a man who I thought was my father. And was very abusive. You know, I was abused a lot with the family because, you know, being a somewhat of an outcast, you weren't treated the way a young man would have been treated if he really knew how to compare it to a family that did not abuse children. And at that time, I didn't know any better. You know, 5 years old, what would I have known? But my biggest challenge was the fact that I was given certain duties in the house which would be considered child abuse. For example, I didn't eat with my family. You know, I'm one of six. I was one of six children. And being one of six children and not being my father's child, he would give me duties like, you know, washing the dishes, and he would make this little box that I had to stand on. And what would happen was everyone would eat, and whatever was left in the plates of my siblings, that became my meal after they would go into the living room to watch TV. And at that time, I would, you know, have imaginary friends. You know how when you're young, you just create friends, and I would be talking to them and letting the dishes soak in the sink while I was eating the rest of the food. Even though it may have been a very abusive form of separating you from the family, but I still felt I got most of the food because, you know, it was a lot more there left than what they were eating. And you were never told to touch the food that was on the stove because we were poor, and that would probably be our lunch or our dinner for the next day. Reason why I start this way is because I think you should have somewhat of a foundation of knowing how a young man who was going through an abusive life couldn't have had nothing to compare it to. So as far as he was concerned, that was life. And that's the way my life was. And as for how I overcame, it got to a point where I was watching certain activities in my home between my father and my siblings that I just felt wasn't right. So one day I was, at this time I'm now about 10 or 11 years old, and at this time I went to tell my mother about what I had actually witnessed between my father and one of my siblings, which was not the right, just wasn't the right kind of behavior. And when I went to tell her, the man who I found out later on was not my father, he punched me in such a way in which I had fell to the floor. And this was a different way of abuse from him to me. See, I'm used to being no clothes on and rice on the floor, and you had to put your knees down, and he called it a two-lick policy, you know, where you put your, because you weren't allowed to cry or any type of wetness to come from your face or your nose. And, you know, you laid your arms out, and you only got two licks, but if you flinched or something like that and you made wrinkles in the bed or something like that, you got additional whippings. But this was different. He actually punched me because he was trying to stop me from telling my mother what had happened. And see, when I got up, unconsciously, I would say I swung back as hard as I could. But instead of hitting him back, I hit my mother. And by hitting my mother, that's when he told me to leave the house. And that's when I left the house at 11 years old. And I really wasn't overcoming any odds at that point. I was still in a situation of hunger, nowhere to go. So I adopted the nearby park as being the place in which I would fool people into thinking I was going to school and this and that, and then I would sleep in the park until the next day. I did that for about 3 to 4 months. And see, back in that day, they had the gazebo. You can clean up and wash up and whatnot. You don't do that today. You get there, you might get killed. But then I would clean up and I would keep going. And I think what really gave me a second chance would be one night when I was on the park bench, and you know, that was my bed. And don't remember now, I'm only 11 years old, but I was living at, I was surviving. And I would lay my belongings out, you know, when it's late at night, about 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning. You know, by that time, anybody who was to be there in their house, you know, and sleeping. So I would sleep on the bench, making sure I washed up and whatnot down the gazebo, put on my clothes and this and that. I only had about so many changes, maybe 2 or 3 changes of clothes. Sometimes I had to wash my underwear 4 or 5 times just to get the little smell out of it, you know what I mean? And then I would, you know, I would consider myself going to school, but I didn't go. So one real rainy night, I mean, it was raining real, real, real bad. And I want you to know that I'm part Puerto Rican and part black based on some of that, and, you know, based on some of my background, but maybe after doing a little Alex Haley, I found that I was full-blooded Puerto Rican, but I was raised by a black man. But then, the reason why I say that is because as I slept on the park bench on that rainy night where, I mean, it was raining hard, a little white Italian lady, she came down and, first of all, she scared, you know, I'm not going to use any profanity, but you can understand what I'm saying. She's scared, you know, okay, to the point that she had this broken umbrella, broken English, but yet I can tell by what she was saying, she wanted me to follow her into this, I guess it was her home. And when I got in there, oh, I could smell this bowl of soup, man. I mean, I ain't know if it was good soup, bad soup, whatever, but I know it was smelling good in there. And it looks like she had the soup. She had some bread there. And she had some sort of change of clothing, but I was a little bit ashamed, you know, when you're in a strange house and this and that, because back in that day, white and black didn't really hang out together, especially an old white lady and a real young black man. That didn't work back in that day. But for some reason, she took a chance and she took me in, had the bowl of soup, and she kept on. That's where I learned how to do so many illustrations and when I'm dealing with vision and motion with Dr. Jay Gittleson, when he sends me around to speak to the various different places, you know, almost 37 states. And by doing that, I get an opportunity to tell my story, and it helps so many people in understanding that, you know, we can't take life for granted. But as I get back to the story, I just want you to know that I was the black kid that lived, or Puerto Rican kid, that lived in the basement in her house for almost 3 years. And she hid me because of the times. At those times, you know, like I said before, if her family knew that she had a black person downstairs in the basement, it wouldn't have been a nice thing for her. And then vice versa for me. I didn't want nobody to see me living with this white woman. Next thing you know, they'd be talking about me. Right? So, but one thing that she taught me how to love my mother and father again, because at that time, I hated them for what sending me out here in the street. I was going to school really for just lunch. Then after that, I would leave. I had a stutter, overbite, and I was diagnosed as being dyslexic. And so with all these things going on, she would still take care of me. And I made that basement a home. And even though it may have had some roaches, it may have had some rats down there, but I made them pets because I wasn't going nowhere. I had to call it home, and I did. Now, I don't know if I'm got off point or I'm on a roll or not.
No, you're on a roll. What was your biggest challenge in overcoming the odds?
My biggest challenge was her. Because even though she got me out of the park and all of this, the challenge was not to get her in trouble for taking me in. And the challenge of and her trying to teach me how to love my mother and father all over again. I would consider that a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was a big challenge because, nowadays, if you look at some of the children today, they would have done some sort of physical something to their mother and father. But see, I had a very strong spiritual foundation, you see. My grandmother was the one who would, you know, prior to me getting thrown into the street, whenever the family would go out, you know, they never took me with them because of the simple fact that, you know, I had a certain kind of hair texture and I had a certain kind of Puerto Rican look and I didn't fit in the family, okay? So they would drop me off at grandmama's house while they went out and had whatever they were doing. One thing my grandmother used to tell me, and I remember I told you I had imaginary friends when I would be eating last, and I was, you know, talking to my friends, you know, imaginary. And then that's when she introduced me to Billy Graham. And Billy Graham was one of those evangelists that spoke about Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. And, you know, at that time, my three imaginary friends, remember, I'm 5 years old at that time. I'll get back to that one in a minute. But you got to remember, I was 5 years old at that time. But she told me that I needed to replace my imaginary friends with God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. So I said, okay, no problem, Grandma. You love me that much, I'll do that. So when I would get back home, that's who I would, you know, always talk to during my little time of washing the dishes and this and that. And I still believe to this day that might have been the reason why I'm at this time in life, because I should have died. The circumstances I was living in, the area I was living in, the poverty that I was living in, the abuse, the attempted suicides, all that stuff could have led to a death, and you would not be hearing this story today.
What was your darkest moment?
My darkest moment was when I was in, you know, of course, Ms. Vitale told me to go to school, and I would go to school. My darkest moment is when I was living in this place, you know, down in the basement. And back in that day, you know, you can freak with a gun. You know, you can, you know, they had guns back in the zip guns, 22, stuff like that. So I had a gun, and I'll never forget when I had graduated from high school. I just had a cap and gown on. They wanted me to get out of the school because I was one of the menaces, you know. And I remember drinking, and I remember taking a gun, loaded up, and ready to pop the cap in my head until one of the cars came by with a bunch of the graduates who said, you know, at that time, Cornelius, 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 like that, you know. And I ran to the window. Ain't nobody know me like that because I never go to school. And that's when they hollered out, come on, man, we're going down to such and such a place. We're going to party a little bit. You know, they saved my life. And I didn't even hang out with these people at all. And yet that was the day that I was going to end my life. And I said to myself, there must be a God.
Was that the turning point when you knew you were going to make it?
No, you know why I didn't think I was going to make it? Because when the gun had 6 bullets in it, and I clicked it.
Hmm.
But it didn't go off. Now, I was drunk enough. I know I clicked it because it popped. And then right after that, I was going to go to do it again. And that car, that's when the car came by. And said, Cornelius, what you doing, man? Come on, let's go. Because some of the fellas I used to play ball with, you know, play some ball in the park and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I went with them. It was the best time of my life. Because I was always to myself, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back home, I actually got on my knees and prayed. And then all of a sudden there was a certain feeling that came inside me. I always said it must have been the Holy Spirit dormant inside of me. And all of a sudden it said, time for me to get control here. And that's when I started to get, you know, started to get turn my life around a little bit. You know?
You kind of answered a little bit, but what was the turning point for you when you knew you were going to make it?
I would say when I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. That's the best way for me to say it because it wasn't a person. You know? It wasn't a particular individual. Because even Ms. Vitale had her limits of dealing with me, you know? Wasn't going back to my mom's. I didn't see my mother for 26 years. When I left at 11, I was 26 years old when I saw my mother again. Now, that's what I meant, not 26 years, but I was 26
mm-hmm.
when I saw my mother again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and what makes it better, that would be about, what 15 years? I didn't care. I just played ball, went to school, played ball, went to school. I only went to school to play ball. Back in that day, you didn't have all those rules and regulations like you got today. Proposition 48, you got to be in school, attendance programs, all that kind. No. As long as you had a good game, the coach don't mind if you played. Flip you a few dollars and you keep moving. It was a different kind of world back then than it is today.
Yeah. You touched upon that.
You got away with a lot of different things. You know?
You touched upon the God part.
Yeah.
So you kind of answered this, but who or what was your inspiration in fighting against all odds and help you out of the darkness?
Well, that's what I'm saying. See, you got to remember, when I said God, I didn't mean just him personally sitting down talking to me. I'm talking about that book called the Bible. I actually started to read it instead of carrying it or listening to other people telling me about it. Most of the answers to my fears, to my pride, my anger, my lust, my envy, smoking, drinking and drugging, lying, cheating and deception, pornography, fornication, prostitution, greed, all these different things were things that were a part of my life. But when I got into the Word of God, I found the words that made me turn away from the life. So that's why for me to say a total individual in those days I'm talking about, I'm not talking about once I met Dr. Jay Gittleson. Now, there's a difference now. See, that took years. I'm talking about moving up into...
I'm making my way around.
You know, moving up into an adult without a life, without a career-bound situation at all. Man, only thing I want to do is play ball. That's all I want to do. And at that time, my academic level was nowhere near anything. It took, I would say, if you're going to say it was certain teachers or certain people in the street, I always thought that God brought people to me. You know, like an angel in disguise, that type of thing, a guardian angel, stuff like that. You know, some people don't believe all that, though. But I do believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it because you can't have a world like this. When I say to you, you wake up every day to the day you don't. So every time I take 6 hours of sleep at night and no one wakes me up, I get up on my own. That determines to me there's a God. I'm not trying to push in the interview a religious career for somebody or go see Jesus. No, no, I'm just talking about if you don't know nothing about the Bible, for you to go to sleep 6 hours and wake up with no one waking you up, where did you go for 6 hours? Think about it. And yet when you're awake, you'll do 6 hours in a day and remember what you did.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you go to sleep for 6 hours and wake up talking about, I think I dreamt about something. I don't know. That alone tells me there has to be somebody who's supernaturally in control of our destiny and our eternity. And the more I lean that way, the more he's been leading me to a plan and purpose that he probably had for me when I was on that little box at 5 years old washing dishes. And why would a grandmama introduce Billy Graham to you at 5 years old? It might have been a plan and purpose that was there the whole time, but I just probably kept on detouring and going into this because, you know, I joined the gang after a while. You know, and I stayed with the gang as my family, man. I tell you, I'd have took a bullet for them in a heartbeat. You know, and that's why when you see these gangs today, and you look at the heart that they have, they don't have a heart to be a gang member. They're just wearing a title. Because if they were going to shoot my mother, and if my mother was sitting on one chair and a gang member was on the other chair and they was about to shoot, they could shoot one, they would have to shoot my mother. That's how close I was to my family when it came to the gang. Ask that question today. You would not even get there. Say, oh, man, you mess with my mama. No, they don't realize when you give up a family for another family, you can't go back to that family. But see, I'm somewhat going on a tangent now.
No.
You know what I'm saying? But I'm just
all relevant.
Yeah.
But yeah. I just wanted to ask you on number 6. Did anyone know what you were going through? And if so, who did you confide in?
Well, I confided in you. I spoke to you about it, and then one day, I mean a lot of years later, well, I was always preaching, teaching, and reaching.
Mm-hmm.
But you gave me a foundation. You gave me a form. You gave me a platform. You gave me a stage. Since I met you, I've touched the hearts and souls of almost over 500,000, you know, people, parents, kids, teachers, and I always have that little word that I would say whenever I have an opportunity to speak. I always tell them this about, if I can reach 10 kids or 10 people in this auditorium, I've done my job. And sometimes the auditorium got over 2,000 people in there, sometimes larger than that. But see, it's you who felt my story was worth being told. And I give you that honor, that privilege, and that glory.
Thank you.
Because I just think that we need to understand that no matter what circumstances we go through in life, God will put people in your life for a reason. And if that reason was Jay Gilson coming in my life, because I think I've been with you, oh, God, science going to be 14. I retired
15 years?
About 15 years. And we've been constantly doing what we have to do. I call it preach, teach, and read. And now that you're in a situation where life has dealt you a set of cards that you may feel may not even be fair, I'm here to tell you, by his stripes, you're healed. It's just a matter of time when you're going to be walking up out of there. No more of that dialysis situation, none of that. because we got plans. We got a mission, man. We got a vision out here. We can't get it done. You hooked up there. I'm over here. And remember, there was a time when you was doing real good, right? And here I was, bad knees, bad back, bad everything.
Yeah.
Because I had 27 operations since 1977. Really, before that was 1970 when I had my first knee operation. But I just know that everybody wakes up from a woman called a mother, starts into the world with a plan and a purpose. It's when you find that plan and purpose is when you're on that role of obedience and following the direction of your inner spirit. Other than that, you're just walking blindly in a world that's going to dictate your destiny, because we got people already thinking about sending missiles one way or the other, and people not even realizing there's not another place for us to fly to right now. And yet we're at a situation now where we just got to pray a little bit more, I believe. And believing in a creator instead of believing in the creation. And we have a problem with that. We're living in such a world where even technology, I love technology, don't misunderstand me. But it bothers me when it's to the point where it takes away from the creativity of the people that are coming up before us or after us. Our children today, like I said before, their creativity is not no longer coming from the inside of them. It's coming from the outside of them pressing buttons and gizmos and things of that nature, not realizing that they can probably create something on their own. But, hey, let's put it this way. As long as Dr. J. Gittleson got me out there on the road, I can save one or two people each time I'm doing it. So they won't live a life that I'm living. They won't give up on a life that I lived. They won't. That's how come I wrote a book said, "And Yet He Lived," with a question mark. Because as far as I'm concerned, from possible jail time to suspensions to being arrested, all that situation, and yet I sit on his phone giving an interview about a life that I know had to come from God, because I'd have been dead. And yet, I buried my mother. I buried my father. I buried my siblings. And yet, with all that hate I had, you would have thought that would have been the last thing I would want to do. But yet, no.
Your purpose.
Yeah.
You answered these questions along the way, so I'm just going to read them because you answered them. What could someone have done to help? Kind of answered along the way. Did you think you were going to make it?
Not at one time I didn't. You know when I felt I was going to make it? When I became worth something to people who thought that I had a message, a vision. They thought that I had a story to tell. And I think the biggest reason why I want to talk to children, parents, really anybody who want to listen to me, is because I'll never forget the time when there was a young lady. She was about 14 years old, and her uncle would always sexually abuse her. And I'll never forget the time when she had spoke to me about it. I was in the school system at that time, but at that time, you didn't have that DIFUS and all that kind of stuff. It was just something that you tell them to go tell the guidance counselor. But she would always say, "No, please don't tell nobody. No, I'm going to get hurt if you do that." I'll never forget that. But then there was a night when I was entertaining. Let's just use it like that. About 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. I didn't answer it. You know, because I'm entertaining. Yeah, you know, you can put what you want to put in there. And that was that young lady calling me, where she was sexually abused by her uncle. She ran out the house. It was raining, like it was when I was in the park. She went in, back in them days, they had what you call a telephone booth. So she was calling collect, because she had no shoes on and no clothes from the waist down. 14 years old. But she was hemorrhaging from the sexual abuse. And because of the rain, it allowed the blood to flow stronger, if you understand what I mean. And she died in that telephone booth. All because I didn't want to stop doing what I was doing. I'm not saying, I already went through the whole thing. I'm not saying that I was the reason for her death, because according to the people from the hospital, they said that she was dead already. She was dead already before she even made the call to me. It just so happens when she made the dial that the phone fell off the thing and just kept ringing, ringing. Back in them days, they didn't have what we have today. From that day on, I listened to every tear of anyone who spoke to me. And sometimes we need to understand, tears don't come from water out of your eyes. A guy could be 6 foot six, 280 pounds, and yelling loud, and you just moving away from him because he looked like a big old beast. Now me, I walk right up to him. Because that yelling that he's doing is really his tears. He don't know how to cry. Why? Because even myself, I told you, when I was whipped, when I was young and whipped, I was whipped not to cry. His tears was his yelling. And I walked up to that guy one day, 6'8", 270-some-odd pounds, yelling at everybody. He had a big old baseball bat. He's about to beat everybody up in the school. I walked up to him, and I put my hand on his chest and told him, I love you, man. Put the bat down. He was like, no, Barker, you don't understand, man. I'm whooping you. I said, put it down. I'm going to hug you, man. I'm going to hug you like a father to a son. He still got arrested. Now, don't misunderstand me now. But I looked in the eyes of the kid and found out if he did want to hurt somebody, then why would he announce it with a bat without using it?
Mm-hmm.
So I just walked right up to him while everybody was saying, oh, put the bat in. No. I walked right up. Because he had enough people in front of him to bat him away like home runs with Babe Ruth. He didn't want to use that bat because he'd have used it by that time. He was crying with an instrument that somebody would have said, yeah, I dare you to swing that bat. Then he may have done it. But since I didn't hear that, I walked right up to him. I mean, it must have been at least 200 people there circling around him. I went right through the crowd, put my hand on his chest, hugged him and took him inside the building, sat him in my office. Unfortunately, he had to get arrested for what he did. But I knew what to do. And that's how come now I understand what God's mission is for me. He wants me to approach the unapproachables. And we got so much of that out there today.
I was going to ask you that. What is your biggest challenge today?
Yeah, that biggest challenge is approaching those unapproachables. In other words, we're allowing so much behavior that's just not justifiable. It's not. It has to change. I mean, I do lectures where I do certain illustrations showing the difference between stupidity versus dignity. And just to think, the things we accept and we justify it as a phase, or they're going through a phase. If it was a phase, then how come we're locking up 18-year-olds for committing murder? That's almost unheard of back in our day. You had to be 27 years old or older. Now it's from 14 now to about, what, 22? And being a former director of a jail, they were coming in looking like kids. The uniforms wouldn't fit them. Some of them had to have alterations for the clothes to put on in jail or in the youth house. But until we go into the backyard of the mental thought of our kids today, our children today, that's only when we're going to be able to show them the front door life. We're not listening to them. We're directing them. We're telling them what to do, but then they're defying what they're going. They're defying us because they don't want to do what we want to do. You can't teach morals and values if you don't know them yourself. It becomes difficult.
I was going to ask you. A lot of noise here.
That's okay.
Kind of also, this may sound kind of a funny question, but have you personally grown from your challenges or not?
Oh, I know I have. I've been shot twice, cut 13 times, 27 operations I mentioned before, two open back surgeries, two brand new replaced knees, okay? And when I'm standing before you now, and I'm on this interview with you now, in better shape than I've been when I was playing basketball at 18, 19 years old. I just know that I had to go through that in order to get this. Oh, I'm a walking story. I'm a walking story, but also should have been a man dead, not alive. I'm going to say even to this day, now being an author of over 20-some-odd books, never read a book in high school, and ended up getting a master's degree, a doctorate degree of humanitarian papers for published work, I'll never, ever give up on a child when half the time that's what we do. Because if they would have gave up on me, I wouldn't be doing this interview.
Have your, Cornelius, have your challenges, last question for today, have your challenges helped you redefine your personal mission statement in life?
Oh, yes. In other words, I'm not walking in this world talking, preaching, and teaching without living it. I want to be I'll always be a role model to whatever I'm talking about. In other words, if, for example, you know, I always speak in parables or I speak in illustrations. If I have an apple tree and I'm teaching everybody how to plant an apple tree, and yet in 5 years there's no apples on my tree, then what good is my words teaching you how to plant an apple tree? I'm just a story. But what has redefined my life is that now, when I speak, now when I preach, teach, or reach, I'm giving what it takes to get apples on your tree. Now that my apples are growing on the tree, now I can legitimize telling you how to plant yours. I can direct you on how to get yours. Before, I couldn't define life because life was beating me up. But now, life don't beat me up. I take day by day. I take day by day God's way. And only for one reason. The proof is in the fruit. And that's the truth. In other words, I'm not going to be telling you something that to do something that I can't do. Before, I used to encourage so many people to do this, do that, you should do this, you do that, but I wasn't doing it. If I'm going to tell you to stop smoking, should I be smoking? If I'm going to tell you to stop drinking, should I be drinking? If I'm going to tell you to stop lying, cheating, deception, what all those, then I can't be doing it myself. I'm telling you not to. That's what I meant about an apple tree. I can't tell you that you're going to have apples if I don't have them. So when it comes to a career in life, or if it comes to you want to do something in your life, you got to do it. Because I can't guarantee you tomorrow. You can't guarantee me tomorrow. You can't guarantee me 2 hours from now, the way this world going. But with that in mind, only God knows the day you're going to leave this earth. But that doesn't mean the consequences of this earth can't make it quicker. Because we're living in a world full of sin. So even though God may have a date for me when he feels I'm God, but remember, we have certain consequences to the choices we make. And right now, there's been talk about a nuclear war. Now, I know that's not in God's plan. That's man's plan. And then they say, oh, don't worry about God to protect you. He may protect me by me being a part of what's going to happen so I get up there quicker. You never know. And then I like to tell you this, Jay, personally speaking, I felt better telling my story because you gave me the ability and the strength to want to take it out the closet. If you remember, I wasn't going to say nothing because I was living kind of nice. I didn't want nobody to know I went through all that. But then when I looked around and found out, as you told me, there's a lot of people like me out there that need somebody to lead them. And when we came together and started doing the different, you know, presentations all over the world, all over the country, really, it became a thing that now that's all I want to do. Help kids, help parents, help teachers, and continue to help you.
And Cornelius continued to be there for me throughout my time on dialysis, 2017, went into 2018, went into 2019. It wouldn't be till 33 months, you know, of being on dialysis that I had the miracle of an anonymous living kidney donor who later revealed himself before surgery. But Cornelius was there for me and prayed with me and on the phone. I'm going to do another podcast episode about an event that I did. A lot of the things that I was doing on dialysis were things that I thought would be uplifting to, not just to me, but to honoring other people. It really, you know, I had people around me, people that I had known for many years that were there for me. And it comes down to a small group. Like, you know, how many friends do you have? You know, how many people in anyone's life are going to be, you know, you're going to be close with, and they're going to be there and be able to relate with you, or, you know, when you're going through something, you know. So you can certainly think in your own life, to anyone who's listening, about those people that you may think are, they're going to be there for you right there. And it turns out to be other people with a certain emotional skill set, a certain availability, a certain emotional availability. Cornelius was one of those people for me. And I always knew he'd be there. He was there for me. So when I brought this back from almost, that would be 2017, now we're in 2023. Today is March 14th, 2023. So to bring that back kind of brought back a lot of memories. And I just wanted to share this with you. I hope that you got something from that interview. But the concept of dialing from dialysis, some of the other concepts that I was doing When I published my book, Mysterious Ways, Discovering the Miracles of Life as I Fight for My Own in June 2022, I had a few professional reviews. This one woman had said she was really taken with the different attitudes and concepts that I was came up with, you know, in terms of coming, you know, not that my life was going to be over immediately, but when you're looking down, you know, that pathway, and I was just thinking of all the things that I could do to be uplifting, encouraging to other people that would in turn be uplifting and encouraging to me. So it was reciprocal healing, as my friend Billy Ayers would say, reciprocal healing, where I was really obviously getting something positive. And my goal was to make it a two-way street so that in this dialing from dialysis, which I'm only sharing now as the interviews, was really something I knew would be important. It would be a keepsake of important to have an interview done like that. And then in my book, I had a chapter called Dialing from Dialysis, which detailed one of the people that was in that. Cornelius, that was part of the Dialing from Dialysis interviews. But Cornelius was a big part of an event that I did that was really important to me. And he was there and he spoke at the event and it was really amazing. So I'm going to leave it at that. This was my episode, Dialing from Dialysis with Cornelius Barker. I'm signing off for now. I'm going to keep giving as much as I can here to different episodes. That was a blast from the past, from 2017. God bless everyone. See you next time. Talk to you next time.